5033. This is an acronym free zone. And we are a subcommittee of the subcommittee, assisted today by Anne-Marie Cosley and Mr. Rocco as LFO staff, and would invite you to come forward. Good morning, Mr. Hearn, and for the benefit of the staff, if you all would introduce yourselves for the record and spell any unusual spellings of last names, please.
Good morning, Chair Johnson, Representative Avakian. I'm Pat Hearn, Executive Director, Government Standards and Practices Commission. With me this morning, and I'm very pleased to have them, are Commission Vice Chair Carl Visentainer, that's V-I-S-I-N-T-A-I-N-E-R, and Commissioner Sue Hildick.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Representative Kovakian. This is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services.
Good morning, Satish. All right, we'll invite you to begin your agency presentation, please.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. In the way of overview, and I understand this is a new process for you and for those of us from agencies, so I hope I'm giving you what you're looking for. The Government Standards and Practices Commission was created as the result of the passage of a ballot measure in 1974 in the immediate aftermath of Watergate. It was actually called the Oregon Government Ethics Commission at that time. It was originally passed by both houses in the 1973 Assembly, but Governor McCaul vetoed it. He did not care for the statement of economic interest provisions, which I know you're familiar with. He likened it to requiring a gentleman to undress in public, so he vetoed the bill. And then the Assembly came back in January of 74 for a special session.
I guess he had no objection to the women undressing.
I wasn't going to go there.
Anyway, they came back and repassed it as a referral to the voters, and it was put on the November ballot in 74 and passed by a margin of approximately 71%. Along with the provisions of ORS Chapter 244, commonly called ethics law, it also included lobbying regulation, which is the registration of lobbyists and the reporting of their financial expenditures periodically, as well as those entities that they represent. The name of the agency was changed by the 1993 Legislative Assembly from Oregon Government Ethics Commission to Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission. The conversation basically was that the term ethics was a little unseemly, particularly if a high-level public official was before the commission and got media coverage. Ethics had too negative a connotation. Government standards and practices would be more palatable. The interesting thing about it is that we soon learned that newspaper headline editors like to keep it short. And government standards and practices is a lot shorter. Our government ethics is a lot shorter than government standards and practices. Consequently, it's now ethics with a small e instead of a capital E. But the function of the agency didn't change, and neither did the law in substance. As a side note, I will say this, that the law, Chapter 244, has been amended in a piecemeal fashion probably just about every legislative session since it passed in 1974. Governor Kulongoski has referred it to the Oregon Law Commission, and they are doing a review with an anticipated near-complete rewrite of the chapter to be coming back to the Assembly for the 2007 session. In the meantime, we're carrying on with what we have. The third area of responsibility of the Commission...
Mr. Hearn, may I interrupt you?
Certainly.
Just because this is an issue that I think we're going to deal with later. I haven't reviewed the budget in any detail, but I understand that the Oregon Law Commission has a policy option package looking for some additional attorney strength in being able to undertake the kind of review that I think the governor is looking for. And my curiosity is, I think that, and I, again, I'll defer to Mr. Rocco because he knows this much better than I, but if that policy option package is funded out of general fund, do you see this as an undertaking that has significance to the state? Is the Law Commission I'm trying to figure out, we're asking the Law Commission to do an awful lot with very few people, and I'm trying to get a sense of magnitude for your professional perspective on how important the rewrite of the whole ethics section is, and to what degree the Law Commission is providing a valuable service for the work that you're discharging with very few people.
Chair Johnson, I think the law definitely needs some work. It doesn't have the bright lines that it needs to have. Too often we have to apply it on a case-by-case basis. And what may appear to be a same situation in one instance has just one little nuance different that yields a different result in the final analysis. So I do think it's important. Whether or not it ought to be done by the Law Commission is something I really can't speak on. But, yes, the law needs some work, and I think the reason it's in such need of work is the way it has been piecemeal amended many, many, many times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Third area of the agency's jurisdiction, and the newest, is the executive session provision of public meetings law. That is the only part of public meetings law in Oregon that has any enforcement provisions at all. And while I'm on this, just let me mention that the public gets pretty incredulous when they call our office believing that their city council or their school board has given improper public notice of a meeting, or they find that a quorum of the body has met secretly in someone's living room. They call believing there should be some kind of regulatory action that can be taken, and we are forced to say, no, if you want to do anything, the only remedy you have is to go sue that body in the circuit court. And that is the only remedy, other than for executive session laws, which we have. So I'm not advocating one way or the other as to what should be done, but I think the public out there would feel a lot better to know that they had some place to go when they feel that their local governing bodies are disobeying public meetings law. the agency considers training and prevention of violations to be number one priority, and I think you'll see that reflected in the presentation material. It's one of our performance measures. Compliance or enforcement would probably come second to that. And again, I think that's because of the feeling that the public needs to be responded to when they file a complaint, they share concerns.
Mr. Hearn, again, I'm going to interrupt you and ask. You've raised a very important issue, I think, and that's the one about where the public enters the system to raise issues about elected people's performance or behavior. How much phone traffic or email traffic have you gotten in the wake of any of the contribution and expenditure articles that have been in the newspaper?
Some, I wouldn't say excessive. There's been some. I think a lot of people do know that campaign finance issues are regulated by the Elections Division, the Secretary of State, as opposed to us. However, I will say that the public has a perception of ethics and ethical conduct by public officials that is much broader than the narrow scope of the law. In other words, the law here focuses on basically two issues. One is the prohibition against using office for personal financial gain, and the second one is that when financial conflicts of interest arise in the course of carrying out official duties, that those conflicts get publicly disclosed. But the public sees ethics in a much, much broader sense. I mean, the public doesn't feel, as an example, I've gotten calls about the controversy of spending campaign funds for personal expenses. There's some, you know, obviously some issues out there in the mind of the public as to whether or not that's ethical conduct. And we have to explain to them that, in fact, the law does permit it and that we don't have any authority or regulatory ability over it. So, yeah, the public is aware. And to go on a little bit more with where the public enters in, I will say that workload-wise, we probably receive, the commission can receive signed complaints. It cannot act upon anonymous complaints, does not act upon anonymous complaints. Receive signed complaints to initiate an action, or it can initiate it on its own motion by you know, at a meeting with a commissioner actually making a motion and the commission voting. That breaks down probably to 90 to 95% are initiated by the public. The 5 to 10 are initiated by the commission on its own motion. And I will also go ahead at this point and offer up that very seldom do we receive a complaint from the public because someone in the public is concerned about the conduct of their public officials. I mean, it's not like their only issue is, gee whiz, we need to uphold the public trust. They simply are mad at somebody and want to get even with them. But I don't think that's unusual when you're talking about regulatory actions. Somebody files a bar complaint against an attorney because they're mad at them, or they file a complaint with the medical examiners because they're mad at a doctor for some reason. So, you know, while the motive for these complaints may be less than pure, it certainly isn't a mitigation as to whether or not a violation occurred.
Representative Abakian.
It seems to me if people have a concern with a state legislator that they might go to the elections division first, but you're much broader than that. I'm wondering how many of your complaints have to do with local officials, such as school boards or city councilors and such, as opposed to state officials?
Chair Johnson, Representative Avakian, probably 98 to 99% come from local jurisdictions. But if you stop and consider the raw numbers, that's not a surprising statistic. There's roughly 200,000 public officials in the state of Oregon. Approximately 46 or 47,000 of those are state employees. And then, of course, you have the elected officials of the state, members of state boards and commissions. But when you stop and consider that there's the elected officials, volunteers, and employees of 238 cities, 36 counties, 199 school districts, and 900 special districts, it's not surprising.
Well, of those thousands of officials that that you have some governance over, if a person has a concern, other than your board, is there anywhere else they can go in order to get redressed for an ethical issue?
Chair Johnson, Representative Bakke, not that I'm aware of.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Good morning.
Good morning.
Is the accused notified when a complaint is called in on them?
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, yes, immediately. If we either email them or telephone them if we're able to, and if we aren't able to, we mail them a letter that day.
May I follow up on that? So if I call in a complaint against Representative Smith, even though you may not take
again.
It up, again, is he notified immediately that a call or a letter has come?
If it's not taken up, no.
Okay.
No, not in all instances. Some of the times it is, but in every instance where we're going to initiate a preliminary review, there's immediate notification. And in fact, if it's somebody such as a legislator or a county commissioner, someone that has a fairly high level, we will do our best to make personal contact with them as soon as we can.
Thank you.
Senator
Morsa.
Pat, now what's the process? You receive a complaint. At what point do you decide? Do you have a who meets to decide if you're going to take it up?
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, I make that determination. The commission has delegated that authority to me by administrative rule. I review the complaint first off to determine if it's within the agency's jurisdiction. Oftentimes it's things, such as sexual harassment. Someone might send a complaint alleging that. Well, that's not part of our jurisdiction. We don't have the ability to take any action on that. So I determine if it's jurisdictional. If it is within the agency's jurisdiction, I then evaluate the material to determine if there's some kind of corroborating information. If someone were to send a letter that simply said, I want you to investigate Senator Morissette because he's using his office for personal financial gain, and that's all they say, we're not going to do anything with that. There needs to be something to substantiate the allegation.
So may I follow up?
Follow up, please.
What percentage then of complaints do you take to the next level?
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, let's assume the whole is those that we do in fact go ahead and open a case on. The first phase of the Commission's process is called preliminary review. The purpose of preliminary review is to determine if there's cause to conduct a full investigation. Cause is a very specific word here, and it's different than probable cause when you're talking about criminal law, as an example. Cause is defined as a substantial objective basis to believe that a violation may have occurred and that the person to be investigated may have committed the violation. So the preliminary review is completed. It must be completed within 90 days of the initiation of the complaint. And roughly it's about a 50-50 result. About 50% are dismissed with no action taken, and about 50% there's a finding of cause made to conduct an investigation. And then the investigation goes forward. That must be completed within 120 days of that finding of cause. And again, the result is about the same. About half of those, that probably maybe 60% of those that go to investigation, there's a violation found in, and approximately 40% there's not, and they are dismissed. And then when we get to that result, those, that is where there's been a preliminary finding of violation at the end of the investigatory phase, and we're going to talk about this some more when we get into performance measures, but the end of that phase, then we get into the contested case hearing phase, and we settle about 90 to 95% of our cases at that point. That is, we are able to successfully settle them without going to hearing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Please continue.
I think I'll go ahead and move into performance measures. And by way of preface, I have to say that this last biennium particularly, it's been very, very difficult with the tremendous reduction in agency resources to get excited about performance measures, to say the least. However, I'm pleased that we've been able to do a pretty good job. We were able to achieve target in 3 out of 4 of our performance measures. The numbers you have in this summary on page 5 of the presentation binder are 2002 calendar year results and 2003/04 fiscal year results. So I wanted to point that out. In 2002, when we still had 25% more staff than we do now, we were able to obtain completion of preliminary review in 71 days. Now, again, this is the phase that the law provides 90 days for. We increased the target in 2003-2004, but we were able to achieve 80 days on completing preliminary review. But I also want to point out, again, because of the reduced resources, the targets were changed, that was an increase of 13% over the previous result period. Number of days for investigation, 2002. Now, that's an interesting one. That's the one we have 120 days for. Our target on that, I believe, was 90, but the result was 58 days. In 2004, that went up to 103 days out of the 120, or an increase, again, of the previous result of 77%. One of the things that we consider to be part of our prevention efforts is issuing opinions, written opinions. We can issue both a formal written opinion that is adopted by a motion and vote of the commission. We can also issue an informal staff opinion. The informal staff opinion goes out over my signature. It is not binding. It doesn't have any precedence. The formal advisory opinion goes out over the signature of the chairperson of the commission. It is binding. It is precedential. But we get requests for opinions routinely, as well as people just simply calling in on the telephone to run a scenario by us and ask if we think they're going to violate the law if they do this or if they don't do that. But we were issuing those opinions back in 2002 in 16 days average. Not too bad, a little over 2 weeks. In 2003-04, it went up to 25 days, an increase of 56%. And then the final measure is the number of training sessions that we present on an annual basis. In 2002, we were able to make 43 presentations. In 2003-2004, only 25.
Mr. Hearn, what are the venue for those presentations?
I have a handout for you, Chair Johnson. I think Mr. Rocco has it, and I'd be happy to discuss that with you. But anyhow, our number of training sessions fell by 42%. This was a real disappointment because I think this is probably the most important function that the agency performs. And the reduction of other staff personnel has just had an absolute ripple effect. I simply can't get out of the office as often as I used to do it. I mean, I answer phones. I investigate cases myself. I write opinions. I file expenditure reports. It's just been a real ripple effect. But let's go ahead and talk about the training venues. Most of the training...
Are you leaving performance measures now, or are we coming back to that?
We can come back to it, or okay. We can continue with it, whatever you'd like, Chair Johnson.
As long as we've got the training venues up on the table right now, let's do that. I want to go back to your performance measures, and Mr. Rocco has communication from the co-chairs that he'd like the committee to review.
All right.
So let's do the venues right now.
Most of these are upon request. That is, they're invitations to us. We don't have a set schedule or anything of that nature. We respond to an invitation. It's normally things like conferences of professional associations, the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, Fire Chiefs and Fire District Directors, special districts, and often just a community, public officials in a community, will put together. For example, a county council, the Curry County Council's had me down there two or three times, and what he's done is he's invited school districts in the area, special districts, cities, and so forth, and I've gone down there and in 2 days spoken to 300 people. That's a real, real valuable sort of thing to do is when they get together and work. We've done the same thing in Jackson County several times out in Central Oregon. The conferences, the annual conferences of those professional associations are an excellent venue because they have a high attendance. But I want to make a comment on the attendance. It's not unlike any other kind of public contact. The anticipation and the hope is that if you go and speak to a session of 25 persons, that each person there is going to tell 5 or 10 other people about it. They're at least going to plant the seed, turn the light on, and It inevitably generates more telephone calls, more requests for information, and even more complaints when we've gone out and done a training.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, do you have a web page?
Yes, we do.
Where elected officials can go on there just to do their own research?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes,
we do. Or see their name. Representative Lockheed.
Do you know if some of these local jurisdictions have either rules, some type of administrative rule or ordinance, or in any other way formally require themselves to do this on a yearly basis? And that's one of the reasons for the request.
Chair Johnson, Representative Vlocky, and I do not know.
Do you find that the same groups ask you to come back year to year?
Yes. Yeah, as an example, I think I did the Fire Chiefs and Fire District Directors Annual Conference 5 consecutive years. This last year I did not.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One more.
What
I'm getting at is I'm wondering if there is an expectation, whether it's by rule or tradition or whatever, in these groups to have you come on a regular basis. And therefore, it almost becomes an expectation on your board's part that it's something you need to do.
Chair Johnson, Representative Vlocky, and my
my take on that simply is that there are people out there, there's human resource managers in some of these jurisdictions, training managers, other officials who have a keener awareness of this than persons in other jurisdictions do. And they know that they have turnover from time to time. They're going to have fresh people that haven't had the training, and so they periodically wish to repeat it.
Following on that, some of these groups seem to me to have ample opportunity to pay a fee for the service. Has your board contemplated doing that?
No, we haven't discussed it. However, this past biennium, you know, the commission is actually charged in the statute to carry on continuing education. And so it's anticipated that it's an appropriate commission expense. This last biennium, however, we have asked people who invite us to reimburse the agency any expenses such as mileage and lodging. And actually, there's only been one overnight trip, so that was only a one-time deal. But they are reimbursing mileage costs.
Well, it certainly seems to me that yes, there may be a continuing expectation that you provide the service, but I can't believe the statute says, and do it for free.
Oh, it doesn't.
So it seems to me to be a reasonable thing that the board might want to look at. Most of these organizations probably profited mightily from having a little refresher course in ethics and the expectations of ethical behavior by either management or employees. So it might be something you'd think about. Senator Morse.
Thank you. I wanted to go back to the performance goals because I don't know how you can put a happy face of pluses on something that you're doing less efficiently than you were before. I mean, sure, you've made the cuts, but every one of them is basically less efficient. And I know that you changed some things in 03 after you had the budget cuts. I guess I want to follow up on also the fee-based service thing. And I know there are bills in the bill that would allow you to charge fees for certain aspects of the service you provide. But it bothers me greatly that you are being basically made ineffective in a lot of cases. And we haven't talked about the quality. We've talked a lot about quantity. And at some point, I would like you to talk about the quality of the work that you provide as opposed to what you think you should be providing in these difficult times. And that includes investigation and the workload and having to go out, take time away from other things to make these presentations that cost you money. In a sense, and takes time away from other things. So I think you're caught in a vice, and the performance measures show that you have lost ground in areas, and I just want you to talk about the quality of your work as opposed to what you think it should be.
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, you know, The agency during the 2003 assembly, the agency staff was reduced 30%. Now, that's 1.2 FTE, but 30% is 30%, whether you're talking about an agency of 4 or an agency of 400. Proportionally, it's a significant hit. Obviously, there was no way we could provide the same level of quality service that we provided before that reduction. But I think it's reflected everywhere. I mean, you can see how the number of training presentations was reduced. We did something in this biennium that in my many years with the agency we'd never had to do before. We had to decline complaints. We simply couldn't accept them. If you recall, we were consumed for much of 2004 with the SAFE Corporation, investigating that agency. And that consumed our one investigator about 110% of the time. He was working 10 hours a week overtime for 9 solid months to handle that case. So there was no way we could do anything else.
What was your process for deciding which complaints of what level of magnitude you would decline? And if one more egregious came in, would you toss one that you were working out of the queue if it was lesser?
Chair Johnson, in this particular instance, and I'll use SAFE as a specific example, the case was so complex, it included so much paper, approximately 15,000 to 20,000 pages of documents, for the one investigator to go over. I mean, it was just physically impossible to consider doing anything else. That we just didn't have the resources to do it. So it really wasn't a matter of what was egregious and what wasn't. We just simply couldn't do it.
So a complaint would come that might be a complaint that you in your professional judgment would deem was worthy of action by your board, or at least opening a preliminary investigation. And you made the decision, given the magnitude of the safe, that you just wouldn't do anything about it?
Yes.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Not trying to digress, but back on page one, it talks about violations can result in monetary sanctions being imposed. Where does that money go?
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, it goes into the State's General Fund. It doesn't come back to the agency at all. No.
Thank you. Has there been discussion in the past of trying to create a more self-sustaining program? We talked about fee-for-service on the trainings. What about trying to create a mechanism where,
sounds a little like the Coburg speed trap to me.
Yeah, sorry. Just trying to help you.
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, I would like to respond. Because, yeah, that's a significant issue. The funding of this agency has been an issue of concern in many places and with among many persons for a long time. It's always been difficult for this agency, which exercises regulatory authority over members of the Legislative Assembly, to be at their pleasure for funding. Especially, the pattern is very clear, especially when you're having a session in the aftermath of a member who was investigated, whether that member was found in violation or not. I do have to emphasize one thing. People get concerned about legislators being investigated by this agency because that's what gets the ink. But on a proportional basis, it's about 0.01% of the cases that the agency has. And it's just not significant in the overall caseload. But if I may, just for a moment, Chair Johnson, there's a bill that was introduced this session, Senate Bill 420. The same bill was introduced 2 years ago. And what it is an effort to identify an alternative means of funding this agency. And in that, what Senate Bill 420 would do is assess every public entity in the state, including state government itself, an amount of money such as $3 to $5 per public official serving that entity. And that would probably generate enough revenue to not only sustain the agency at this year's governor's recommended budget, but to add some resources for training and perhaps some compliance review, some audit functions or whatever. Now, there was a hearing held on that bill 2 weeks ago today. But the entities, the local government folks, AOC, LOC, League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, school boards, etc., vehemently testified against it. And so I don't imagine that bill is going to get, very long legs on it. But again, the point is it's getting the issue out on the table, and it's identifying something to be done.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Realizing that the caseload is hard to predict, either in frequency or intensity, in the case of the SAFE issue, did you consider coming to the emergency board for an appropriation for additional staff because of the uniqueness of that? It would seem to me that, Ken, that would be a logical application of emergency.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think that opportunity was there. It would be hard to predict what the result would have been, but it could have been a course of action to take.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you.
I'll pass for now.
Okay.
I'll come back to that.
Please continue.
Did you want to return to performance measures?
Yes, please. I don't know. Ken, would you like to now share the memorandum from the co-chairs? And if you would, Ken, give us a little background of the genesis of the memorandum.
Madam Chair, members, when the co-chairs reviewed the measures, they were generally satisfied with them, but had a couple of suggestions for changes that they wished the subcommittee to consider. In particular, they were appreciative of measure number 5, which is a new measure that the agency has proposed, which would be on the page 7 in your book, number 5, percentage of contested cases settled before hearing. And that one they recommend go through. And I think the agency's already taken this through the administrative process to get it approved. So it's been approved by the Progress Board and other entities. They were interested in looking at adding additional measures on numbers 1 and 2 to just track the percentage of complaints completed within the statutory time frames of 90 days to determine whether a complaint is should be taken up, and then to actually complete the work within 120 days. On the training presentations, although this is a good outcome, I mean output type measure, they were also interested in getting some kind of a measure of its effectiveness, of either like a customer, like a survey response after the training session to say how many people thought it was worthwhile, something like that, or to try to track the number of complaints that came out of or fell away in that particular area where the trainings were held. And I know that's a very difficult thing to do, and I don't think it's able to be done, but they would like some thought given to trying to get something more than just the number of presentations. And I think it helps to see who is being trained, and that if that can be worked into a measure, that would be an effective change, I think. They also talked about considering a measure regarding the percentage of cases that were upheld on appeal, but after talking with Mr. Hearn, there are so few cases that go that far that I don't think it would really be effective. So I don't know if that would be worth taking on at this time.
Do you have any comments or response? I understand you've seen the memorandum ahead of time. Is there anything you'd like to offer the committee?
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I think the suggestions, for the most part, are real positive, and I certainly will recommend that the commission adopt them. But I will make a comment here on the two, and that on this suggestion number 3 about tracking the outcomes of training. I certainly think we could do a customer service measure. I don't know of any way possible to measure it by the prevention of violations. I don't know how you would ever know that, but certainly we could do develop a survey instrument to take with us to these training presentations and ask the folks to fill them out. I think the measure that we've already adopted that's been approved administratively, that is the number of cases settled without contested case hearing, is a very valuable measure. The legislature for several sessions has been concerned with regulatory agencies using various methods of alternative dispute resolution to keep the costs of formal proceedings down, and I certainly think this is in that spirit, and I think it will be an effective measure. And I will have to echo Mr. Rocco's comment about the fifth suggestion, that is regarding the measure of cases upheld on appeal. We have one at the Court of Appeals right now that was argued in October. Prior to that, I think we had one in 5 years. Or something of that nature. So, I mean, it really is so infrequent in the total picture, I just don't think that it would really tell us anything valuable.
Mr. Hearn, with your permission, I'd like to go back to Senate Bill 420. I didn't attend the hearing, so I have no knowledge of what record was created there. And I'm asking you, to the degree you're able, to just be a factual reporter about what comments were offered, you said AOC and LOC came and the school boards came and vehemently testified against it. I'm curious as to why, because it strikes me that were I to serve on some local government board, it might be an interesting prophylactic to present to my insurance company that I had gone through an ethics training. There might be some significant value to $3 or $5 or whatever. I obviously haven't read the bill either. But that seems like a de minimis amount of money to be able to present to an insurance company that my board had been trained on the state's expectations for ethical behavior of elected officials.
Chair Johnson, I'll do my best to be a factual reporter, but I think it's pretty safe to say that the general crux of the testimony in opposition to the bill was along the line of not another unfunded mandate. And, you know, we're not going to get what we pay for here.
And yet when you look at the people that invited you to come, and I presume somebody issued an invitation, you didn't just show up and say, here, I want to talk to you about ethics. They're largely local officials. They're special districts. They're special districts and local officials. There's a lot of them.
There are.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and out of that come very prescriptive requirements for teachers in our state. It seemed to me it would not be unreasonable in terms of $3 to $5 to make it for new officials that, whether it's city, county, state, that it becomes somewhat mandatory on a periodic basis to go through an ethics training. And then I pay for it personally. That's just part of the requirement of being in the public arena. To have that kind of rationale and that kind of discipline and to convey to the public that we are serious about this issue of ethics and legal conduct and to have that training. I don't know whether that line of reasoning has ever been explored, but it seems to me that there might be some basis for it.
Chair Johnson, Senator Morris, certainly such a requirement would have to be legislated into the law. I will say there are other jurisdictions, other states, that do have such requirements for some kind of continuing education for their public officials at all levels.
Senator Morris. Thank
you. I was going to get at this before, but this is a better time to do it. I would have suggested, and I talked about a bill that would do something like this, and I talked with the sponsor of that particular bill. I would have just had that as part of a registration fee of filing for office. People who want to serve the public, that part of their filing fee would be to fund the agency, but I really like your suggestion better. Well, it could be a combination, because I think that the individual should be responsible. I could see why the cities and counties and special districts complained about the previous bill, and I thought that would be the case. But I think the individuals who want to serve and are asking people to elect them should pay a small fee for the privilege of running for office. Now, the idea of an ongoing training program is, I think, could be part of that package, that's what I would think would be the legislative route to take on this.
Chair Johnson and Senator Morissette, I know you're a former local elected official, and so am I. But I don't know that this charging someone who files to run for a small city council would give them much incentive to run. I got to share this story with you because I think it's very fitting. In 2002, I live in the city of Staten. In 2002, we had 3 council vacancies. Nobody filed to run for them. I got called and was asked to run as a write-in. I did. I was elected. and I resigned after almost 2 years simply because I didn't have the time to give that it needed with this job. But that's my point. Three of us were eventually elected. We were all elected as write-ins. Nobody wanted to run. And I think that's likewise, I think that's probably true in a lot of places in the state.
But Mr. Hearn, are you making the case that a $5 or a $3 add-on to a filing fee that was specifically designed for ethics training would be an additional bar to not wanting to run?
Well, Madam Chair, that's not what I said. I said I don't think it would give much incentive. It might not be a discouraging factor, but I don't think it would be an incentive enhancement. And the other point I want to make on that is this. Elected officials are but a fraction of, or token of the public officials that are under our jurisdiction. So I don't know how that would shake out from the standpoint of the kind of revenue that it could generate.
Well, we're trying to help, but I don't.
Well, I know it's tough.
Well, I guess some of us are struggling, and I don't mean to put words in anybody's mouth, but I think we're struggling with trying to figure out if you raise the water in the harbor, all the boats float. And that if we start someplace reassuring the public that people who are seeking elective office, whether it's high elective office or at a local level, are willing to make a contribution towards their ongoing, their personal, ongoing training in the expectation of ethical behavior for elected officials, maybe we can't reach out and grab every single employee of a state agency, but it certainly seems to me that if you got to start someplace, start with the low-hanging fruit. And if there's any attempt to revive any of these concepts at this juncture, to see if we can get to a point where at least people that are seeking the public's confidence in their vote can give back to them the expectation that they'll be up to date on the ethical expectations. Representative Vlasic.
Along those lines, I would wonder if you're making it mandatory that all these people pay this fee, that if it then obliges you to make sure you're in every single city, every single school board, every single county, giving those folks their money's worth, which means that your staff might need to be quadrupled in order to fill the new service. I don't know what the answer to that is, but maybe you can shed a little light.
Chair Johnson, Representative Vlasic, and I certainly think that they're going to expect something in return, and I'm with you. If we're going to, if they were to be charged for running that office and running for that office, and that revenue was to go to this agency, then I think the agency certainly would have a tremendous obligation to provide training and education to them to help them avoid violations. And yes, it would be a lot of work.
Mr. Hearn, what's the universe of people that have to file statements of economic interest?
Madam Chair, it's approximately 4,000.
And they are a mixed bag of elected, or describe the universe.
Yes, I will, Madam Chair. It's all elected state officials. It is designated state agency heads. Not all. As an example, I think it's interesting that the director of the Economic Development Department doesn't file a statement of economic interest, but the director of Fish and Game does. I imagine that's an oversight.
Imagine that.
But anyway, then it's all elected city and county officials, all city and county planning commissioners, all city and county chief executive officers, and the chief executive officer and chief business officer of all public school and community college districts. And then in the election year, there's about an additional 300 candidates who must file them.
And who, if you could just bear with me a minute, Senator Mercer, is there a fee to process those?
Madam Chair, no, there's not.
And were there to be a fee to process those, would that be problematic?
I think Madam Chair, I think you'd have to ask those upon who the fee would be imposed, but I certainly wouldn't see it as a problem for us.
Senator Morsad.
Could you get us a list of all those? Of everything you just mentioned, all of the people who have to file the fee. I started to write them down in my head. I would appreciate a list.
Chair Johnson, Senator Morsad, I'd be happy to.
Mr. Hearn, if you'd provide it to the professional staff, and then they can make sure the committee has copies of it, that would
be I'd be happy to.
Representative.
Before we leave this sheet, it looked like maybe we were getting ready to. I wanted to ask you something about number four again. I think there's a tendency to look at a percentage of cases settled prior to a hearing, and is that number, but more cases are settled, to have the impression that that's a good thing. When, in actuality, I think that sometimes years of having a precedence of settling more and more and more cases ends up having your sanctions really be more of a first offer towards settlement as opposed to a real sanction. And I'm wondering if you, well, first, if you end up doing this and providing these statistics, I'd be interested to know whether or not those statistics are a good thing or a bad thing in your board's mind, meaning the number of cases settled, or whether or not you're concerned that you're watering down your authority by being forced to settlements because of budgetary reasons.
Chair Johnson, Representative Vaki, and the commission has always preferred to settle cases rather than litigate them, and I think the prevailing philosophy has been that the commission has two responsibilities in its compliance efforts. One is to educate people and to hope for future compliance. The second one is to sanction. And I believe that it's been looked at in those priorities. I might also say, however, that when you talk about feeling an impetus to settle a case because of budgetary reasons, I can tell you that that's a very real factor. Litigating these cases, either in contested case hearing or in circuit court, which I'd like to explain in a minute, is extremely expensive. I mean, this agency, some of you may know, is the only regulatory agency in Oregon State government that has a provision that requires the court to order the agency to pay attorney fees to prevailing parties. It is the only one. And what happens is, when this only happened a couple of occasions, but we have to come before the E-Board. And we had an experience of coming before the E-Board when the costs were incurred prosecuting legislators. And it was not a very pleasant experience. There's certainly, but I mean, the circuit court process, you know, that is, in lieu of a contested case hearing, a respondent can demand that the commission sue them in the Marion County Circuit Court. And the cost is incredible.
Thank you. Just keep this in mind, and you don't need to answer it now, but if someday you come back to this committee and you say we're settling 65% of our cases, I would want to have some kind of qualitative analysis along with that, because it seems to me your mission at the heart is really your consumer protection agency. You're protecting the public from unethical conduct of officials. And I don't know if 65% means that you're meeting your mission or if it means you're not meeting your mission because you're settling things away at a lesser sanction than you really should have to. And so just someday when you bring back the number, have some kind of qualitative analysis along with it.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Two very quick questions. I'd be interested in your personal opinion on the violations that you pursue. How many of those are truly based on malice versus those that are based on ignorance?
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, that is a difficult determination to make. I don't think very many are the result of malice. certainly many are the result of lack of knowledge. But by the same token, very many are the result of nonchalance and arrogance. I attended an ethics workshop in November at the University of Portland, and it was part of a panel of public sector and private sector and academic ethicists from across the country. And we were asked the question, what causes ethical lapses? And we debated it for some time, and the consensus of the panel, I think there were seven of us, were two factors, and it was greed and arrogance.
Yeah, I would think we could be proactive on this issue and generate additional dollars for the Government Standards and Practice Commission by enhancing the upfront training. So that way you take away that you didn't know, you didn't understand. And that goes back to my question about the web page. And I think there's a way to generate revenue and to be proactive upfront. But again, that doesn't address the arrogance or the other issue. The second question I have, and again, I'd really like a very candid answer on this. What happens if you have an elected official with deep pockets and you've got a questionable issue? Have you ever had to sit there and say cost versus the benefit, knowing that somebody with deep pockets could take, it could cost the commission several million dollars, say, or hundreds of thousands of dollars to try and bring resolution to an issue?
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, we are directed, as far as legal counsel goes, by the Department of Justice, as are all state agencies. And so when we're making these determinations, we're in a great deal of consultation with our legal counsel. I can say that 10 years ago, or in the early 90s, a cost factor was never a consideration, either by the Department of Justice or by the agency. That isn't true today. It is, in fact, a consideration. I'm not saying that it necessarily tips the scale, but it is a consideration.
Okay.
Madam Chair, did you want to go back to performance measures again? I wasn't sure that we got through there. I know you said you had some.
Really, the piece that I wanted to get to was Mr. Rocco's memorandum.
Okay.
And or actually the co-chair's memorandum through him. And I don't know what else you have to add on performance measures.
I don't have anything. You want to go on to priorities?
Please.
And I apologize for the squint-sized type here, but that's the way these computer programs are. As you know, we're an agency-wide budget. That is, we're not budgeted by program. And so it's hard for us to say, well, we've got 4 FTE on this function and we've got 5 FTE on that one, because we'll all do everything in the office. I mean, I wait on customers at the counter, I answer telephones, I file away lobbyist reports and statements of economic interest, and I investigate complaints. So what I did was we identified, and we'll say we did this in discussion with both Satish and Mr. Rocco, what are our primary areas of function in the agency? And so we identified training, compliance, administration, lobby regulation, and statements of economic interest in that order. Again, based on the governor's recommended budget, which is at 4.0 FTE, and then my staff and I sat together and did the best estimate we could of proportionalizing our time in each of these five functional areas, and then we were able to proportionalize approximate cost. They're in the priority they're in because, as I've already indicated, there's a strong feeling and a strong commitment to training in the hope of avoiding violations. compliance came in second because the public needs to have their concerns responded to. We feel that that was important. Then we went down into the administration function, which is basically our agency executive assistant and myself. Lobby regulation, which includes lobbyist registration and expenditure reporting by lobbyists and the entities they represent, is the fourth one. Because that's the important information, I think, for the public to know. Now, statements of economic interest fell into last of the five, and you may question that, and it may seem strange, but the truth of the matter is the value of the information on a statement of economic interest is dubious. And I filled one out myself, by the way, so I'm familiar with it. But the public, when they ask for copies of those, is often pretty dismayed that they're as vanilla as they are.
May I?
Senator Morse.
Yeah. I've often thought you should be making those for the current year instead of the last year. Would that make a difference? Less dubious?
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, I really don't know. I don't know that it would. I do think that it's probably a good idea to consider having somebody complete and file one upon assuming office and upon ending office. But that's not required at this time.
Representative Avakian.
Are you saying that it's probably a necessary thing for us to do, but we're just not getting the kind of information or enough information, or that the whole exercise in doing a statement of economic interest isn't valuable to you?
Chair Johnson, Representative Avakian, no, I think it's important, and I think it should be done. I just don't think what's required under Oregon law is revealing enough. I don't believe you need to get real specific. As an example, I used to be a court administrator in California. We filled them out down there. They were like income tax returns with multiple different forms. I mean, you could have 5 pages or you could have 25 pages. But it would categorize things. It would categorize income, you know, greater than $100,000, less than $150,000, something of that nature. It would categorize investments in certain things. So you didn't have to reveal your entire personal financial statement, but it gave somebody an idea where your economic interests were. That's what it's called, is a statement of economic interest.
Senator Morrison, Senator Morissette.
Thank you. You basically answered my question I was going to ask. Thank you.
Senator Morissette.
No, that's fine. I think you addressed what I was thinking about, which is overkill.
Let me ask you this. Let's assume that you had a hypothetical board someplace, and two of the board members were doing business with each other. Let's say they owned a building in common, an office building. I don't remember that form with enough detail, even though I filled it out. Could one ferret out whether two sitting board members shared a common interest in a piece of commercial property?
It's possible. There is one there to indicate business interest. There's a category for that, but it would depend on how it was owned. I can share a personal story. We had a couple of city councilors out in Staten several years ago who owned a building construction business together. And the whole reason they ran for the city council is because the city had given them a hard time on some of their development proposals. And they got on. But, yeah, they had common business, and I don't know that it actually created, just on out of the sheer existence of the situation, that it created a conflict of interest of any kind.
Senator Morissette.
My experience, well, and I think it holds true at the legislative level, but at the local level, you have to declare a possible conflict of interest, and if you have a conflict of interest and declare it, then you're okay, right?
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, there's two kinds of conflict of interest. There's a potential conflict of interest, and there's an actual conflict of interest. If the conflict is potential, you make the declaration, and yes, then you can participate. If it's an actual conflict, you make the declaration, you may not participate.
Senator Morse.
My understanding of Senate rules is that we are never refused from the vote, even though we may have an actual conflict of interest.
Chair Johnson and Senator Morris, that is correct. There is a provision in the law for members of the Legislative Assembly, and it says they make the disclosure and then follow the rules of their respective house. And the rules of the respective houses are that if you're there, you have to vote.
Charge for a training presentation.
Actually, that's a great segue. I'd like to go back to the training presentations for just a second. Has your board ever explored the possibility of using external panels to do the training? For example, reaching out to the retired legal community who might have some interest in doing some pro bono work. The law is the law, and whether or not it comes out of the mouths of your staff or people that would like to assist you in doing the trainings. And then second of all, whether or not your board gave any consideration to regionalizing the trainings so that instead of doing one-off trainings in Baker City and then come back here and do another one-off training in John Day, that you would do a great deal of publicity, make them announced widely that they were going to occur, and draw people to you on a more regional basis. I know there are other groups right now that are doing train-the-trainer sessions very successfully, and I just didn't know whether you discussed that at all.
Chair Johnson, there has not been any discussion about having other groups do the training presentation, but it certainly is something that has a tremendous amount of merit, and I think would be a good exercise from the standpoint of regional training. I'm 100% behind the concept. I think it's probably more cost-effective, and you get more cluck for your buck. But have we given any real thought to doing it? No, we have not.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I just talked to the attorney from the League of Oregon Cities who say that they do a training, during their annual conference. Are you present at their training?
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, I have spoken several times at the League's annual conference. I did not this last time. I did the time before that.
May I?
Yeah. Please follow.
In fact, I'm going to work with the League and the counties and hopefully Senator Johnson and our esteemed leader to try to go back and take a look at that Senate bill, but in conjunction with the League and the Associated Oregon Counties in terms of training, because they said they do a training on ethics themselves, whether or not you're there, they do it. And I'm just wondering what kind of coordination there potentially is and actually is. So,
if there was one statewide curriculum so that all the elements were covered and you all were responsible for developing that curriculum or even going to an outside panel of experts to help you develop the curriculum. I know that there are practicing attorneys right now who do ethical presentations for elected boards. I also know they charge their hourly rate. But there may be some real opportunity here to find cost savings. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we misapplying the term ethics in this discussion, or are we talking about compliance? You have statutes and compliance to those statutes, and then you have ethics, and they're entirely different. They can be one and the same, obviously, but in many cases they're entirely different because ethics deals with those gray areas in life when you make decisions based on what's right, may not be lawful or unlawful, versus what's expedient. And it seems to me the term ethics, we may be actually confusing the public.
Chair Johnson and Senator Morris, excellent point. You're absolutely right. Ethics is different than this law that this agency enforces. I always say in my training presentations, just because something may be legal, in other words, it doesn't violate the statute, doesn't make it ethical. I agree with you 100%. We probably are misapplying it. I guess if we wanted to be clinical, we would simply call it government standards and practices law. But the public doesn't know what that means either. I mean, we get calls all the time when people believe that, for instance, they've been treated rudely by a public employee or something. And, you know, they say, oh, government standards and practices, that's got to be the outfit I need to go to. And obviously we can't do anything.
And what do you do when you get one of those calls? You have somebody who's been treated very shabbily by, or allegedly very shabbily by a state employee. Do you just tell them, not us, sorry, and hang up, or?
No, no, Chair Johnson. We, in an instance where it would involve a state person, we would probably refer that person to the governor's citizens representative.
Thank you. Okay, we're back on your priorities. I'm sorry, we keep...
That's fine. Actually, I was through the priorities, and I guess that takes us to the reduction option. And actually, this is more than 10%. It's almost 20%. But basically, what it is, it takes away the policy package for the second investigator that's in the governor's budget. That's the only place I can come up with the 10%. And if we take the 10% there, there's no point in leaving 0.4 or 0.5. I mean, it would not be money well spent. It wouldn't result in any kind of increased performance or effectiveness of any way. So basically, what this would do is put us back to where we currently are with the one investigator.
Any questions from the panel?
In the appendix, Chair Johnson, we have our annual performance measure report for 2003-2004. It's essentially the same information we've already discussed. Performance measure analysis. And then starting at page 15, there's some statistical information, a comparison of the last 5 years of opinions issued by the commission, the numbers of statements of economic interest sent, returned, and the percentage of filings that are returned. I just might digress a little, if I may. In the early 90s, the percentage of compliance with filing these was very, very low. I mean, it was unbelievable that there would be perhaps 25% non-filing. And for some reason, the agency had not given compliance much of a priority in that. This indicates clearly, I think, that it's turned around, and now compliance is exceptionally high. It's about 99.9%. Page 17 reflects lobbyist registrations, again, for the five calendar years. And then 18 and 19 show lobbyist registrations on the first of each month for the preceding year. And, of course, now that the assembly's in session, that increases.
Yeah. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I know that you can't tax or ask an individual lobbyist to pay a fee. Is that correct?
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, yes, it is.
Okay, but you could ask, for instance, or we could ask the Capital Club as a unit to pay a fee. Is that possible?
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, a fee to lobby?
Yeah.
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, no, I don't believe it is possible. The 1993 Assembly passed a lobbyist registration fee that would have imposed a fee of $50 upon every compensated lobbyist or any lobbyist who represented an entity. In other words, they might be an employee of a company, but it's part of their job. They did that. It did not impose the fee upon the retiree who's down here lobbying on something out of self-interest. The ACLU sent in their lobbyist registrations without the fee. We sent them back, and they said, you can't charge the fee. We said, well, the law says we have to charge the fee. They challenged it, and it went all the way up to and was heard by the Oregon Supreme Court, and the Oregon Supreme Court said that it violates the freedom of speech provision of the Oregon State Constitution.
May I follow up?
Follow up,
and,
please.
And then that would apply to a group of lobbyists, I mean, the association having to pay the fees as well.
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, I think that's probably a legal question, but I would assume so.
I would only make the observation that I think the Capital Club makes an attempt to have their own code of ethics that they attempt to enforce and ask their members to comport with. And if they were charged a fee, that would certainly be a disincentive to have them belong to the Capital Club and thereby get the enforcement of that level of ethical behavior.
I was just looking at a way to, well, okay, that's fine.
If you want less of them.
So that concludes your presentation.
Yes, Chair.
Yeah. I would invite your board members, who I presume have come at distance. I know Ms. Hildick has many other responsibilities, but Oregon has had a long tradition of citizens serving in uncompensated roles on these boards and commissions, and I would just ask before we conclude if they have any comments that they would like to make.
Chairman Johnson, I am the Commission's newest member. I have attended one meeting, so I am climbing the learning curve with the Commission and its members, and I am very proud to serve there. I agree with you that ethical conduct has got to be at the centerpiece of public service. And
Ms. Hildick, would you mind still pulling that mic closer to you?
Got it?
And please say your name for the record.
My name is Sue Hildick.
Thank you.
Could you hear me? Okay. So I'm climbing the learning curve. I think you've raised some excellent points here this morning, particularly on the prevention side and what might be able to be done with revenue raising. So I'm hopeful that the Commission will be able to explore those as we go further.
Well, thank you for your service on this Commission. I would invite your colleague to make any comments.
Thank you, Chair Johnson, members of the committee. I'm Carl Vicentiner, Vice Chair of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. I've served for 3 years with trepidation at first and pride now. I'm very proud of our staff, the work they have done, and have been very frustrated that we cannot address fully what I think is our principal obligations to the citizens of Oregon, but to the degree we have been able to respond, I think the level of that response has not diminished in its quality. It's just the extent of services that we've been able to provide that is diminished. The only observation I'd like to pass on is that it's been observed that there was vehement opposition to local entities having to pay a per public official charge. And my observation was is that several of the people who testified against that are very strong supporters of us, our staff, and what we do. I don't view their opposition being the means of funding. I view their opposition as not out of my purse, please. So I think otherwise they are very supportive of both increased funding and increased participation on our part in serving them.
Thank you very
Thank
much
you
for
this
clarification. Senator Morsett.
I would highly recommend that you invite representatives of the cities, counties, special districts, and school districts to come to one of your commission meetings and have a discussion with them, because I too feel that. In fact, I just talked to one of them in the hallway a little while ago, and she had several suggestions about training and funding, suggested that they would even be willing to pay for training, I mean, their organization. Now, I don't want to go any further than that, but I think you should talk with them, because you're right, they're not, they are very supportive of what you're doing, but they just don't want to have to cough up the money for every single volunteer that works for the city or all of the staff and so on. That gets to be a lot. So, thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
I want to go back to ORS Chapter 244 on public officials using their official position for personal financial gain. Can you send us some black and white examples of how that plays out? As I read your language here, I got caught on the little clause that says for the financial gain of a relative. In the Legislative Assembly, we hire our spouses to work in our offices. And I'm trying to figure out, going back to Senator Morris's question, where does the law and the ethics separate or come together. I struggle with that. To me, it seems like there's some real gray areas in the work you do.
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, there's a lot of gray areas in this law. And I think I indicated in some of my earlier comments that we often have to do this on a case-by-case basis, because there's just, you know, it may look like the same animal, but there's one little nuance that makes it different. Yes, the law does prohibit public officials from using their office for personal gain for themselves and for relatives. You brought up something here that, very honestly, I get asked about all the time. I constantly get asked, why can legislators hire family members to work in their offices? And I tell them, I don't know why. Because I don't. I can't hire my wife.
Well,
there's nepotism laws and everything else. So I don't know the answer to the question. My guess is it's just been done for so long that everybody thinks it's fine.
Well, and I'd like to follow up just really quick.
Well,
you know, part of the reason a lot of us are placed on certain committees is because of expertise. And, you know, short of announcing a committee, you know, I work for a company or I do work with a company that may have a potential gain from this, I'm not sure how you separate yourself out. I look at my Ways and Means Committee on Transportation and Economic Development, and I can go right down the list of people who, in one way or another, have experience in economic development or transportation.
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, there is a provision in the law referred to as the class exception or class exemption. And basically what it says is that when you take an action that impacts all residents of the state or all members of a particular profession or occupation to no greater or lesser degree, conflict of interest simply doesn't arise. And I think that was put in there specifically in consideration of legislators and consideration of state board and commission members, etc. But of course, likewise, the law treats conflicts of interest on the part of legislators differently. I mean, all you have to do is disclose it and then go on and participate.
Just one last quick question. So your guidance to this committee, your guidance to a person such as myself who's a chair of economic development and transportation but has a business that's involved in economic development and transportation, is to disclose?
Chair Johnson, I believe in being conservative. I don't think it hurts to disclose. I think it's a lot. It's easy to underdisclose, but I don't think you can overdisclose. But that's a personal judgment call for the official in question.
Oh, and I'm not trying to take this, but you know, I think some of the action is through, I'll say, ignorance, not knowing what you should do and what you shouldn't. I guess you're right. It's better to be conservative and over disclose than to under. I guess.
Senator Morris.
Interesting.
To answer your question, or the unresolved question for you, Pat, as to why members hire family members, I have the greatest respect for colleagues that come to this and serve sacrificially. And that is the case for many, many, many members that don't have either the independent financial means or the company that they work for that's willing to continue their salaries while they're serving here. And $1,283 a month is not going to support a family. And even with the per diem, it just doesn't get there. So I think it's a matter of necessity for many members. If they are going to serve, they have to have that income in order to keep their families afloat. And I personally think it's a bit of a tragedy to be so exclusionary in this whole process called representative government, that we don't allow the opportunity for more people to take the plunge and say, I want to serve. And the way we do it, it does exclude a lot of people from this process.
Chair Johnson, Senator Morris, I appreciate that very much. And what I was specifically referring to was that I am perennially asked what legal authorization
or what legal provision is there? And that's the I don't know I have to answer.
One thing that you might do for the committee, in fact, I'm going to ask you to do it, is it seems to me that a reoccurring theme here is we don't have enough people to do the work. The Law Commission may or may not get the author or get enough people to go ahead to do the review that they're going to do. We have all these gray areas. I think it would be very helpful if you and your board prepared a list of issues that you think could profit from some greater discussion in the public arena or by certified smart people someplace to bring some level of refinement to the problem. I guess I'm unwilling to walk away from a hearing and just say, we don't have any money, so it's screwed up, and it's going to stay screwed up until we get more money. I'd like some kind of a recitation of where all the issue areas appear for you and your professional staff that you think are really detrimental to the public's understanding of compliance, to the public's general understanding of the kind of behaviors that they expect from their elected officials. It certainly doesn't have to be an exhaustive list, but you mentioned several things today. And if you could bring that for the second phase of this discussion, it may be instructive in helping us understand how do we bring you a greater set of abilities to discharge the expectation that the public has of your agency.
Right.
Good. Absent any additional comments from the committee, I will remind us that we are not meeting tomorrow or Thursday. And so unless there are any final comments or questions, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5033 and declare us without objection adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Johnson.
And thank you for coming.